You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Helena Maria Viramontes. She's the author of the novel Under the Feet of Jesus, which has been recently published by Dutton. She's the author as well of the Book of Stories, The Moths, and other stories published by Arte Publico. I wanted to begin by asking, one of the funny things about writing a first novel is that you never know whether the difficulties you face writing this first novel are the difficulties that other people face in writing theirs. And it's one of those nightmares of aloneness. But what was the particular difficulty of writing Under the Feet of Jesus?
Well, for it being my first novel, the fact of the matter is that I was primarily a short story writer, and just even thinking of the word novel terrified me. If you notice, the Moths and Other Stories was published in 1985. It has taken me exactly 10 years to publish Under the Feet of Jesus, and during that time, I in fact started two novels, and I put them down. I lost steam. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no direction, but I continued writing. And then I had my training in script writing at the Sundance Institute, and that sort of kind of pushed me over the hump in trying to look at a novel not so much as this big, huge marathon, but in fact to look at it in small little pieces from various camera angles. And so that's with that in mind that I thought, well, let's see what I can do with it. And then I started looking at this the question of a young girl in the barn and kind of exploring this the relationship that she had with this barn. And then when Estrella took a hold, she pretty much propelled the novel. So then I made a commitment that I was going to stick with this novel like a marriage, and just say I'm going to through thick or thin. I'm going to see what I can come up with this. And 2.5 years later, that's what happened.
That seems to be actually an ongoing quest in recent Latina fiction. I was speaking to Sandra Cisneros, mm-hmm. who told me that negotiating the mountain of the first novel, it's almost like a task that everyone is expected to complete. And she felt that coming from her background, she had to begin by teaching herself what a novel was. What is, after writing Under the Feet of Jesus, what is a novel?
Oh, wow. What can I say? If you notice, this novel was perfect for me in the sense that it was a map that I put forth in the novel, and there's different points of view, and there's different shifts of times and space, so there's no real structure to the novel per se in terms of being a conventional novel. I have no idea. I think a novel to me is simply a story that's told, I guess, by the weight of its truth. And a novel could be 100 pages long, or it could be 150, or it could be 200 pages, or 500 pages. But it all depends on, I guess, what I want to say with the novel, what the characters want to live through the novel. That ends up being that. The definition of a novel for me. I guess at this point, I don't know, Michael, it's difficult.
Well, it's interesting because, a listener wrote me a letter asking me what a poem is. Mm-hmm. And I said, the best I can do is to give you a list of poets that you might read. And in each case, if you read the poem, that will tell you what that poet thinks a poem is. I think that very much the novel is defined by its individual examples.
Exactly.
But at the same time, I noticed, for instance, in your acknowledgments that you thank Gabriel Garcia Marquez for his invitation and then his insistence that you attend his storytelling workshop at Sundance. What kinds of things did you learn there?
Well, two of the things that I remember most. One of them, you can imagine what kind of workshop it was. It was phenomenal. I mean, from 9 to 1, we sat with a man who spun stories for us and basically reaffirmed what I've always felt, and that's really the fascination with the story, you know. What makes your imagination bite into a story such that you want to go home and you want to retell it over and over and over again to the point that you begin to believe it? I think Gabo said when he used to listen to his grandmother tell the stories, he didn't even remember the stories that she told, but what he did remember was her gestures and the confirmation of the way she spoke the story as if it were the truth that fascinated him. So he, you know, from that angle, he wanted to tell a story so that people could believe it. So it can be a theme of believability underneath. I myself learned from him. One, he told us once, and it burned like a tattoo in my heart, that great literature is almost sentimental. And I like that idea. You know, I like that because you can get close to sentimentality, but ultimately pull away. You know, and that gave me the permission to write about a love between a mother and a daughter, to write about the first kiss, write about these things that I think are very basic and very important to our lives. But somehow, people have kind of grown away from that kind of subject matter. And the other one he told us was always keep your eyes and your heart and your mind open. And that has a certain resonance in the fact that when you're writing, you do, your sensibilities do open up like a satellite, and you begin to see things as you would never see before. During the time that I was writing Under the Feet of Jesus, it was a spectacular process for me, because in the whole process of creating this world, I mean, I'd be driving down the street and see the illuminating skies as I would have never seen them before. And then, you know, think about them and then come home the next day and put that down. You know, I remember driving once and seeing a bird flying across with a stick in its beak. And I thought, what a perfect way to describe Petra, you know, to for her to notice this bird, because she's making a home of her own wherever she's moving. And so are these birds, you know, and migratory. She's a migrant worker. I mean, it just all connected that way.
I'm speaking to Helena Maria Viramontes on the occasion of the publication of her first novel, Under the Feet of Jesus. One of the things that I think holds novels together, and I think it holds this one together, are sometimes, well, internal image linkages, the way you just mentioned about the birds. And so, for instance, I noticed when I was reading that Petra, the mother, eats a lot of garlic for her veins.
Right, right.
And it said, Alejo, a young man that she has taken into her family and is caring for, thinks of her as having an aureole of garlic, much like the aureole around the Virgin Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the book, one goes into a store, and there is a picture of the Virgin Mary next to a picture of Elvis and a picture of Marilyn Monroe. And at the feet of the Virgin Mary are the piles of garlic. And so I begin to wonder, you know, how do these chains evolve?
Well, you know, again, I think that's the spectacular process of writing. The whole, when you're into something, I'll tell you, the world, when you're into another world, the world that is not your own, but you're living in it, it's a spectacular feeling to have. And I really have faith in the subconscious. I really feel that somehow, if I'm honest and if I give these characters the respect and the integrity that they need to grow as people in a particular space of pages, that my subconscious will kick in. Now, you know, I had no idea about, you know, the birds and, you know, the migratory aspect of birds with the migratory aspect of love with migrant workers. This just all didn't make connections to me until the first draft, after I wrote these things out. Because I mean, when you're in a rural setting, of course there's beautiful birds that you're constantly seeing, and for me, you know, during the process that I was writing this and getting into these people's realities, Like I said, my real life opened up to me, and I saw those birds, and I saw the sky, and I saw the eucalyptus trees fanning themselves as if they were dancing girls, you know. And these are the things that I eventually recorded. I feel that they're not forced imagery. Every time I resist that. Every time I see that I'm trying to force an image, or every time that I see that I'm trying to carry an image into a place that it shouldn't be, or that I'm overplaying it, I pull myself back, and eventually the image does drop out. But those that come organic from the story, from the characters, and from the scenery, I leave.
I'm curious to go back to what Garcia Marquez said about a story, great literature being able to be almost sentimental. As we know, the extremes of the preposterous are verged upon by magic realism, in which, however sad, however miserable life may be, there's a counterbalance of miracles that can come to the rescue. In this book, Under the Feet of Jesus, there's a very great resistance to any kind of fanciful solution that will help these people. Even as a writer, you seem to hesitate to send them an angel.
Yeah.
In fact, quite the reverse. In the course of this book, the head of the statue of Jesus falls off and he has detachable hands. It seems to be a very cavalier attitude toward the shrine. I wondered what.
Well, but you know, the other side to that, Michael, is the fact that at the end, they do have an angel, and that angel is Estrella. You know, when she realizes, I mean, there is that question of faith, the faith that Petra has in the Holy Family and the traditional Catholicism, and in the not the rejection, but certainly a different kind of spirituality that Estrella, the young protagonist, pursues, and eventually realizes the capacity of her heart to love. When she realizes that, it's an empowerment, and she feels she becomes the angel in the end. So I think you're right to a certain extent, because I am a social realist. There is no way that I can write and not be truthful in what I'm writing about when I'm capturing a reality that is a reality. But at the same time, you know, I really, really respect the resiliency of the human heart, you know, because if not, I mean, I see it time and time again. If not, I would certainly despair. But every day, you know, I see women who live on the edge and you know, where a dollar makes a difference, and they get up and they take care of business. I mean, still, those children are walking down the street and going to school with their combed hair and their book bags, you know. And, you know, even though there's a reality that is incredibly difficult for them to maintain or survive. So, I don't know, I there's a lot of hope in that book, I think. And you know, it's not false hope. I think it's a lot of, again, it's a respect of the human heart.
Well, I guess I'm talking here about the role of the writer. For instance, toward the end of the book, the family is taking this young man to the doctor. On the road, their rear wheel falls into a puddle of mud so deep that they can't move forward. The wheel is spinning. They get out of the car and they try and build traction with sticks and stones for the tire to get over. And there is this man dying in the back of the car, and still the car doesn't start. And I'm sitting there reading, and I say, oh, but the thing that's not letting this car start is Helena Maria Bermontes. Come on, you know, give them a break. Yes, along comes a bus full of migrant workers, and the truck stops, and they get out and help. And finally, they are out of the mud puddle, but on their way to a humiliation at the clinic of another ghastly and terrifying sort. So one has to finally ask the writer, well, don't you want to throw them, you know, to
You know, it's interesting because during the process of the writing of the novel, Sandra and I kept up a fax relationship.
Sandra Cisneros?
Yeah, Sandra Cisneros kept up a fax relationship because we were both working on our novels. Both at many times felt terrified by them, by this negotiation, as she would say, of this information. And so, you know, it was wonderful to be working with her. But one of the things that she kept saying is that, Elena, you know, she would write a fax and say, God, wouldn't it be nice to listen to them laugh and listen to some jokes and you know, ease up on this and make it funny, you know? Then I'd write back and saying, you know, that the pesticides got reversed in California, and now they're some of the banded pesticides that are the most toxic are through the, you know, Wilson administration being reversed and they're being sprayed. How can I laugh at this? And then she'd come back and say, you're absolutely right, you know. Yeah, I don't know, Michael. I sort of worry about myself in that way, and not that I see the dark side of things, but the fact of the matter is that I want to present the reader with the realities, the truthful realities of what's happening now. And in that way, it's, you know, I really believe I believe that people inherently are good, and I believe if there's information that they see, they read, that they'll do something about it, you know. I did the same thing with the Caribou Cafe, my short story, which I think is one of my most famous ones, but inherently and intentionally very political, in the sense that I was dealing with the death squads in El Salvador and bringing this woman to Los Angeles, so connecting actually three countries to this particular incident. And you know, I just really I wanted at that time for the readers, especially in the U.S., to wake up and to tell them, look at what is happening. Your U.S. tax dollars are supporting these people who are brutalizing women and children. And, you know, and most of the incidences that I described in the story are truth. I mean, I snipped them out of Canadian newspapers. I was living up in Canada at the time, you know. And we were getting a lot more information in Canada about what was happening in El Salvador than what we were getting in the U.S. here. You know, well, obviously, you know, that people, you know, there was a resistance to that type of information because Reagan was in power. You know, he was partly supporting this. You know, so I don't know. I feel that I cannot sort of lie to people. You know, life is hard. Life is very, very hard. But that's why, I guess, for me, the power comes in, is that even when you're up against the fence, even when you're living at the edge, that somehow, all the time, you know, there is that kick in where you get up in the morning again and you face another day. And that, I think, has true... I need to honor that. I need to honor that resiliency, I guess. So I don't know. They are faced. I mean, they are faced with all these obstacles. But in the end, I think Estrella comes out a real winner.
I'm speaking to Helena Maria Viramantes on the occasion of the publication of Under the Feet of Jesus, her first novel. You're now teaching writing at Cornell University. I wondered... You know, since you are from Los Angeles and you are now in a very different environment, both as a teacher but also in terms of comparing the environment of this novel, which is very hot and in the fields and sweltering, mm-hmm. and now you are in a snow belt. I'm wondering if this is affecting your work, if this changes your worldview.
Well, you know what's interesting is that I've talked to various other writers who have made major moves, and they you know, and asked them. Of course, I was incredibly, you know, interested in how this change would affect my work, and went on to talk to a lot of my elders, my elder writers who I trust, and they said no. The general consensus was, listen, Elena, you would have more objectivity and your work would be stronger because you'd be moving away and your imagination would just have to work a little bit harder and so be a little bit better. So I don't see it as a major severing of my ties with the realities that I write about here in California. At the same time, I still don't have the confidence in me to have a second book coming out which will say yeah, this is, my writing is better and stronger because of it. So we'll see about that. You know, going up there to Ithaca and being, I've never, I mean, I saw snow when I was 17 years old. This is all totally new to me. But it also works as a metaphor, you know, in the sense of being in a place that is totally alien to me. But I also see it, I guess, as women who've crossed the border and have left children in Mexico or left children in Guatemala, and they come and they do what's necessary in order to send back money, in order to maintain a quality of life, like food and schooling for their children. And I think, well, okay, you know, so I'm leaving my family here and I'm going over there, but you know, shoot, I have a position there. I have my children are with me. You know, I have a husband who's fairly happy there. So I try to keep everything in perspective, and I see that women do it all the time.
One of the impressive things about Under the Feet of Jesus is that it is very definitely the work, it seems to me, of a writer. And I was talking recently to Dorothy Allison, and she was repeating her well-known position, which is that for a certain number of years, it was necessary in the woman's movement, in the feminist movement, that there be a complete acceptance of any kind of story, but that at a certain point, you had to determine whether or not you loved literature, mm-hmm. and that certain things, however truthful and however honest and unexplored, have not been approached in a literary fashion, are not entering the art form. Where does that line come for you?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Michael, because, you know, like Under the Feet of Jesus and my first collection of short stories, The Moths, it's not, I feel sort of sad that they're not the type of books that, let's say, a high school student can pick up, or a junior high school student can pick up and read for enjoyment, because of the stylist that I am, and because of the subject matter that I write about. The accessibility, I suppose, for younger kids, is not there as much as for, let's say, undergraduate or graduate or people who love to read. To a certain extent, for the longest time, I actually wanted to write a conventional novel. You know, I think that's why my two novels failed, because I was forcing, I was sort of trying to write something that I think Chicanos and Latinas should be able to read when they're in high school, and I couldn't do it, Michael. I couldn't do it. I mean, and I think that's why those two novels failed, because I was really resistant all that. That was me, you know, in terms of my fascination with how to tell a story, with my darker side, I guess. You know, with my darker side, I guess. And so, I don't know. I know that it takes a number of years. I know The Moths, for example, took. The Moths was very quiet for a number of years, very, very quiet. You know, the people were using it in classes throughout the country, but it was a very quiet up until about 88 or 89. Then all of a sudden, you know, 3,000-4,000 copies a year started selling, and now it's over, you know, 16,000-17,000 copies that have been sold. And I think Under the Feet of Jesus is going to be the same way. I think there's going to be, people are going to begin reading it, and it's going to take a while for them to really truly understand the complexity the complexities that I deal with in the novel. It deals with, you know, the migratory aspect of love, migratory aspect of life, spirituality, coming of age, certainly sexuality as well, you know. So all these different themes are in a geography of a novel, and so it may take another while. So I don't know. I sort of feel. I mean, I guess Dorothy's right. You're absolutely right. I mean, in some way, I've always been one to push publications of stories that need to be told. But for myself, at this point, I want a story that will last. And I know that I have to sweat bullets over this story. And I did sweat bullets over Under the Feet of Jesus, in the sense that I didn't want it dismissed as a political novel. Mm-hmm. I did not want it dismissed as a propaganda.
I have a final question. You were talking about the obligation to tell a story at its level of truthfulness and difficulty, and that these things will, in a sense, build the book to last, as opposed to the propagandistic elements. I wanted to talk to you about the level of time in the book. I remember that when I reached a scene in which the family is crossing a freeway, it's a difficult crossing for them, they get to the grocery store, and there they meet for the first time a character, Perfecto, who has been in the novel all along, and it's only midway through that chapter that you realize that it's a flashback. And I wanted to talk to you about how you built the time scheme of Under the Feet of Jesus.
Well, you know, in many ways, when you deal with things like memory, are very fascinating to me because, to a certain extent, it can be unreliable, and it also works in a very chaotic way. And I think in terms of developing this novel, just about the time that Petra began thinking about the whole idea of love, when she realizes that Alejo and Estrella are falling in love, it makes her reflect back to her own how she met Perfecto Flores, and by the end of that kind of flashback, there is that indication that she is slowly going to fall in love with him. See, so that for me that worked in a perfect kind of logic. Illogical logic in the structure of the novel.
So you would say, in other words, that the time scheme is that of associational emotion.
Right.
Yes,
exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
It makes complete sense. So that, in other words, the emotional development of these characters determine when they tell the stories they tell.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what I mean about giving the characters the space and the integrity and the respect to tell their own stories. I mean, I am sort of the medium, but in fact, they will tell their own stories because of that. For example, the ending of the novel was very different than the one that Estrella has. But Estrella was just very strong, and every time I kept pushing my ending, it just wasn't fitting, and it wasn't fitting because Estrella was a very powerful character by that time, and said, "No, this cannot be," you know, and so I let her have her own ending.
I've been speaking to Helena Maria Viramontes. Her new novel, Under the Feet of Jesus, has recently been published by Dutton. Thank you for joining me today.
Michael, thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book, off the mouse, pop.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.